there are so many women out there that are taking a stand against gender inequality and are paving the way for the future generation. Ordinary women that are creating a more inclusive and powerful society, free from stereotypes, racism and sexism. And I'm here to share their stories with all of you. Stay tuned, because this is WEN Power, your source of inspiring, powerful and positive stories. And I'm here to discover how we can change the narrative, one story at a time. I am your host, Ilaria Biancacci, journalist and founder of WEN Power. Hello and welcome to a new series of WEN Power podcast. If you have been following us from the beginning, you know that WEN Power aims at changing the narrative on women's rights and gender issue by sharing more inspiring, diverse, inclusive and powerful stories of ordinary but extraordinary women that are changing the world. With this new series of podcasts released on the occasion of the International Women's Day, we want to celebrate and acknowledge the stories of women journalists that are an inspiration for us. Let me share with you that missing narrative and perspective, and let's dive deep into their lives and experiences to discover what motivates them, why they choose to become a journalist in the first place, and what are they doing to help and support more journalists to progress, develop, learn, and grow. In this episode, we discuss the importance of diversity and inclusion in the newsroom and the role of sisterhood and allyship with Janelle Aldred. Janelle is a regular contributor to conversations about media, politics and justice, a former newsreader and journalist for BBC, ITN and ITV. In 2021, she published her first book, Communicate for Change, and today she runs a communication consultancy helping people, brands and organizations, and she's the deputy chair for Women in Journalism UK. Thank you, Janelle, for joining us on WEN Power podcast and for sharing your story and experience with all of us.
No, thank you so much for having me.
I will take you straight into this interview with a question that I like to ask to all my guests, and is, what is that you're fighting for today, Janelle?
I think what I'm fighting for today and hopefully always is for every person to be able to live out their full potential, no matter who they are and no matter what defining characteristics might mean they shouldn't be, or it's against the odds, or there's a glass ceiling. So yeah, fighting for every single person to be able to reach their potential.
Nice. It's quite a challenging one, no?
Well, yeah, it's a massive, massive challenging one. And I think there's no one person that can do all of that in the world, not me, not anyone. But the way I try to fight for that is by doing that for myself in spaces and hopefully spreading that to the people around me. And hopefully they'll spread that to the people around them. And I'm sure somewhere else all over the world, other people are also doing this. And hopefully then it spreads like wildfire.
Yes, like a wave, you know, just a little bit of a domino effect. Yeah. First question for you is, why did you decide to become a journalist?
I kind of fell into journalism more than decided, which was interesting. But then if I look back from when I was a child, I was always really interested in news and stories and TV. But the actual decision to do it as a career was because I was kind of at the end of the road. If I'd tried a couple of other things, they didn't quite fit. And I met my dad, packed me off to the BBC to go and talk to one of his friends. And this lady said to me, you know, have you thought about being a broadcast journalist? You've got the perfect personality for it. And I said, oh, no, I've never thought about it. And then from that, I looked up the university courses and kind of that kind of took me away on a path.
It's interesting how sometimes, you know, opportunities just fell into our path, into our lap, and then they shape the people that we began after. But there was a person or someone that inspired you particularly when you were a young journalist or even when you were a young woman?
I think the people that inspired me were more of my mentors or people who took an interest in my career and were able to not only help me, but show me how to do it and inspired me to work hard. My uni tutor, my journalism uni tutor, Sarah Rowlands, she was a big influence for me, and she was a mum. She had like five children and she had like this really intense life, but she was still at university teaching, you know, several courses. And she really inspired me to kind of go as far as I could. And in moments when I felt like, oh, this is not for me, I want to quit, She absolutely held on to me and helped me to kind of finish. And so that was a real inspiration to me. And I remember once saying to her, I just feel so busy looking at this woman who has, you know, like five children and a husband that she cares for and a home and travel commuting to uni every day. And she said, Janelle, it just gets busier. And actually, I think I took that on board as a fact that, you know, it's nothing is easy in the way that there's never any sacrifice. Some things are easier than others, definitely, but in the sense that nothing is ever completely trouble-free and neither is life. And I think I took that on as an inspiration or as a model or something to look at in the fact that you'll always have to work hard in some way, shape, or form. If you're good at something, more stuff gets on your plate because actually, if you're good, people give you more things.
Exactly.
Not to always see that as a negative, actually, to see it as a kind of a driver.
This leads me nicely into my next question for you, Janelle. And it's, have you ever had a mentor throughout your career and growing up as a woman and as a journalist? And would you like to share your experience with us?
Yes, I've had loads of mentors in my time, so many. And you know, you have mentors, some of your teachers at school are your mentors in a strange kind of way. You might not recognize it as that relationship at the time, but some of them teachers take on a great mentor role in terms of giving someone a spark of something that they can do. You know, my parents were also my mentors in some ways. And then you have more formal mentors. I actually find most of my mentors, we haven't always had that conversation. Will you be my mentor? I think sometimes actually it's something that's happened really organically over someone that you meet that over time you can kind of pull on for advice. And sometimes it's not always directly about how do I elevate my career. Sometimes it's how do I cope in a newsroom with like really strong personalities. Sometimes it's how do I cope with rejection? And you just meet these people who give you nuggets of advice. Some people that becomes a more of a long-term, lifelong thing. I have some people who've been in my life giving me advice for years and years. And sometimes it's people that you meet in a workplace that you don't see after you've left, but whilst you're there, they're really instrumental. And then sometimes it is a more formal thing where you and that person are both a bit more formal that you're being mentored. But I don't think that's anything that should ever stop because life never stops changing and evolving. So as long as you have to change and evolve, I think it's good to have people in your life ahead of you who can say to you, you know, this is would be a great stage of life to maybe think about this, or a great stage of your career to think about this. And I think that's a lifelong learning position.
A bit of an interesting question here for you. Do you remember your first story or assignment?
My very, very, very first assignment was actually I was at a newspaper on work experience. Actually, I was went to the Birmingham Mail on work experience, and I got a byline of which I can't remember it was now, which is terrible. I think somewhere someone of my family has the newspaper. My first TV piece that I did was around the Windrush. It was the anniversary of Windrush, and now I feel old because it was like I know the 50-something anniversary, and now we're on like 70. But that was my very first piece that I did in broadcasting, and most of my career has been in broadcasting, and that went on Midlands Today. And I remember being really, really proud and kind of pushing to talk about the story, and then getting to talk about it. So I got to do a few kind of packages about little things. Some of them are based in Caribbean culture. I got to do a package about seasonal affective disorder. So those were kind of my first few bits of broadcasting that I did myself. Yeah.
There is something about the first story or the first assignment. I think it always sticks a bit with you, you know, and it's just a nice memory of how you started your career. Talking about your career, and what were the biggest challenges that you had to face as a journalist? And maybe this is also an opportunity for you to tell us a little bit more how you move in these years in the media industry.
I think some of the big challenges in career have been around sometimes knowing whether to stay in a job or whether to move on. I think for some people, you know, they kind of get to a place and they want to stay there forever and work their way up. I'm not really that kind of person. I probably tire too easily of things, and not that patient. So I think one thing that was always for me was the questions that I used to ask myself around, can I grow any more here? Can I influence any change here? Can I work on the stories that I'm most passionate about here? And if the answer to that is no, how long do I think it's viable to be in that position where I can't really do those things or answer those questions? Yes. Am I happy here? But everyone's really different. Some people don't mind if they don't like the environment, if they're getting to do what they want to do. For some people, it's an all-in deal. And I think those have been some of the big questions in my career. I was a bit of a hopper arounder. So if I felt like, right, I don't think I can achieve any more here, or I've hit the ceiling and it might be a 5-year wait to get to another ceiling, right, I think I'd rather either take a sideways step, sometimes take a downward step, but take a different step to push my career into a different direction. So for me, that's been the challenge for me, has been how can I control or have some control over my career? Because when you're in journalism or broadcasting or papers, a lot of it's not down to you. It's down to your editor. It's down to the person making the decision about who does what. As someone who very much probably a bit of a control freak, especially over my own life, more so than other people, I never really quite felt comfortable with that all the time. Because sometimes it's a bit like people are leading you with a carrot dangling in front of you of what can be in the future. And for some people, they don't mind waiting 10, 15 years for that future. And you know, for them, it can work out in really, really big ways. But for other people who have a bit more tappy toe feet, you know, sometimes I think the benefit of my career now, as you know, a consultant and doing different things, is that I've done so many other things. So I have a lot of facets to my career knowledge, if that makes sense, and my institutional knowledge, because I know about broadcast, I know about digital journalism. You know, I've gone and worked in the third sector, worked for a charity doing digital strategy, testing some of the storytelling things that I've learned from journalism. I also, you know, run a TV channel, so I see that big over corporate view of what that looks like to lead a team and to be in a team. And so I think it's about, you can't always know how you want your career to pan out. But I think you have to kind of be guided by your personality and by the things that interest you. And I think a lot of people try to do what everyone else tells them to do and tells them is the way. And I think that can actually be very challenging if you're finding that's not working for you. I think the other thing that I, you know, just sometimes being a woman coming from an ethnic minority, you know, some people really don't want to be pigeonholed into doing stories about just their community, be that LGBT, be that the disabled community. And some people really feel passionate and feel called to telling stories about their community and being in that space. And they don't see it as a box, they see it as really important work. And I think, again, the challenge is to decide what is right for you and then convincing someone else, that your editor, that that is also the right thing for them. So I think the challenge is always matching up where do you want to be with what's on offer and what you can do, and how does that play into the kind of the long game of what you might want from your career.
I like that. Very interesting. Where are we in your opinion, in terms of diversity and inclusion in the news? And how do you think we can improve it, or what can we do to improve it?
When you're in newsrooms, you feel like the diversity is really not good. And I don't think diversity is where it should be. It is at entry level, but it's not the higher you get up kind of the food chain. And that is what I do think needs to change. But interestingly enough, when you go into the corporate world, it's further behind, in my opinion, than newsrooms. I think what journalists need to ask themselves is, in any space they're in, whether you consider yourself to be a diverse individual, whatever that means, or not, is, you know, what does truth and justice look like? Because a lot of journalists get into journalism because they want to tell the truth, they want to seek justice, they want to tell stories, they want to highlight issues. And I think it's about thinking, okay, but how do I wrestle with that in the space that I'm in? Is this a fair space? Is there justice for everyone in this space? Are there space for all stories? And if there's not, think about what part of that solution that you can be. But I think in newsrooms, definitely where I think there still needs to be a push is in senior leadership. We do have more women, but not enough. We do have some ethnic minorities, not enough. I think, as well as that, the spread in ethnic minorities can often be very targeted on Black and Brown people. And I think we need to expand that out to other ethnic minorities too, you know, like Southeast Asians. You know, you don't see many of them in journalism. And I think that's really important. And, you know, in certain parts of the country, there are big Eastern European communities and European communities. And I think, where are their stories reflected in the telling of what we do? And so I think it's about making our diversity truly inclusive. You know, how many times have you seen an editor that you know with sometimes a visible disability you don't often see all the time, or and you know that we know there are so many more invisible disabilities that are, you know, naked to the eye, neurodivergent people. I think it's about reimagining what senior leadership looks like and what leadership looks like in the journalism space. And I think still very much, if you say you're editor and you immediately picture a white man, well, that says everything about what we expect our leadership to be and look like. And I know, obviously, even within white men, there's obviously diversity because they don't all have the same experience. It's not always about the fact they've privileged, been to private school. That's not everybody's story, but that's the majority story. And so I think it's about thinking, how do we reflect the audience back to itself? Because to me, that's the importance of inclusion. The audience is diverse. The audience includes everything. And the best people to tell stories are people telling their own stories. And that's fine at, you know, at the more junior levels, or even getting up to correspondent, you know, presenters, you know, you see lots of diversity there. But the decision making, the people deciding the agenda, the people deciding what we talk about, the people deciding who to hire, who to fire, you know, what's the agenda? Unless that becomes more diverse, what we will continue to see is people distrusting media, media being disseminated. So more and more, more people starting up their own news things. There's nothing wrong with that. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But people must recognize that's an answer to what feels like a very homogenous monoculture in terms of what news is and who decides it. And everyone wants to know that they matter. And I think
Exactly.
it's really, if people, audiences are declining for news, like facts, audiences are declining because the audiences you want to reach are not like the audience you already have. So if you want to get those extra numbers are in places that you're not currently servicing. And so it's about thinking about how do we service these other audiences to attract them in. And it's not about doing wall-to-wall coverage on, you know, everything all the time. But when people know that they're consistently not on the agenda, then why would they tune in? Why would they buy the paper? Why would they want to get involved? So I think it's about really thinking about, are we serving our audiences well by continuing to do things the same way we've always done them?
Exactly. Or maybe you get into the agenda because there is a particular political situation, or like think about as well the Black Lives Matter last year. And there was, I was reading a research, there's been a spike, an increase of experts and journalists called specifically in that moment just to talk about this. And then when the interest in that topic was gone, and then bye, we forget about you again. Or when it is about I don't know, gender-based violence, we invite women to speak, but then out of that day, then maybe we don't invite more women to talk about that. Or Black History Month, or other, you know, particular circumstances that will change the agenda for just maybe 24 hours or a week or a month, and then that's it. We are back to 0, and we keep going with what we were saying before. So it's I think this is really, really important. And there is another part as well that comes to diversity and inclusion, but it's more related to actually gender equality and gender equity. So women in journalism, there is a research again, numbers, they're not really representative, but sometimes they are a very you know, like a punch in the face of for the reality. 24% of people heard and read in the news are women, and the percentage goes even lower when we see at women called in as experts or women in the newsroom. And you mentioned this before, there are more and more maybe junior profiles or students, but when we look at the hierarchy and we look at the le leadership, then we don't see as many women as in junior roles at or entry level. So what do you think is the state of gender equity and gender equality right now in the newsroom? And did you see any changes from your experience as well?
I do see changes, and I think it's, you know, it's hard because as much as we have a long way to go, sometimes if you don't celebrate the wins, people feel like nothing has been achieved, and then people feel very weary. So there have been changes, but not enough. We're 50% of the population. So when you're 20% of the leadership, that says that if clearly there's something that's going on that's not correct there. And I think it's important just to recognize that if we truly believe that we're in a meritocracy, and I don't, because I don't think a meritocracy has ever existed anywhere. But if we're in a meritocracy and we're 50% of the population, talent which is naturally occurring in all genders, races, etc., there's 50% of women who could lead. To me, that's like a no-brainer. So I think that we really have to start walking the talk at some point and maturing the conversation past the women don't ask for pay rises. All the research shows they do. Women don't ask for, you know, all the research shows that they do, but people are often rebuffed. And I think, how long can we have the conversation? It'll take 20 years. At some point, we must get closer, no? So if it's always 20 years away, that's just hope deferred and change deferred. And I think at some point we have to say change is now. We need change now. There are no more excuses. We have loads of women in junior roles. We have loads of women coming into the business. So if they're not reaching the pipeline, then it must be the people at the top who are causing the issue. So I think there's something in there that we do just need to, at some point, stop talking and demand a bit more action. And it's hard because the same people you're fighting against, so to speak, are the same people who give the opportunity. So there's always an awkwardness in that and a bit of a clash of culture in that. But I think we have to also be honest about that and say there is a clash here because you are the people that were coming to for opportunities, but also you are the people blocking the opportunities. And how do we have this conversation openly and honestly in a challenging way that is tough, but that brings some solutions? You know, I wrote Communicate for Change. It was published last year. And, you know, I long for the day that we can have nuanced, direct conversations that result in something actually happening. Mm-hmm. Because the longer that we kind of tiptoe around it because we're scared we won't get the power, well, we'll never have it.
Yeah, exactly. And do you think sisterhood in the newsroom exists? Because sometimes, you know, the worst enemy of women are women itself. I don't know, in my own experience, I did face a bit of, you know, jealousy and like not really supportive work environment, like with my peers, and actually had more support from male journalists rather than women. So what's your experience on this? What's your take on this?
I think this is really interesting, kind of coming off the last answer about, you know, men still holding the power and being able to give it, but blocking it. But that's genuinely not all men, because there are some men who are very, very good at giving power away and encouraging women and building women up. I think when you want to take away power from people, a different dynamic does enter the scenario with some men. But what I will also say is that sisterhood, too many women don't experience it in newsrooms and in general, I would say, in the working world and just in general in life. And so what I would say is that sisterhood is a great ideology. And I think it gives us something to strive towards and something to move towards in terms of women helping women. But I will also say that far too often it does not happen. And the myth of scarcity has often pitted women against each other. So there can only be one woman. There can only be one person of color in the room. There can only be one LGBTQ person in the room. And so what that then does is it makes people think, well, if there's going to be someone in the room, it needs to be me. And so that is where I think a lot of it has come from. But in this day and age where we know that we can open more doors, we shouldn't pull up ladders behind us, I think we really need to begin to move away from that. And I wrote an article last International Women's Day about this. And you know, sisterhood is an ideology, and when it works, it's great. And it does work in pockets, but it's not widespread enough to make an impact. And actually, if sisterhood was a real thing, there'd be more women in leadership positions. There'd be more women going through, because as you say, it's not always the bad man that's pushing women out. Sometimes it's other women pushing women out of the door. And when women are in leadership roles, I've known this, experienced it. Sometimes the team does not respect you in your role. Sometimes the team does not support you in your role. Sometimes even when women leaders start to climb the ladder, the backlash from peers, the backlash from their, you know, people who are working to them, to their vision, to their leadership, is sometimes not there. And that is from women and men more junior than them. So it's not just a simple thing of there's senior women holding people down. Sometimes there's this unhealthy exchange going both ways. And sometimes when a woman gets promotion over someone else, you know, goodness me, all hell breaks loose. And so I think we really need to look inside. And I think a lot of it starts with the way people feel about themselves, and the way people feel about their careers and how it's going or not going. But I think there's two, as much as there are systemic problems and problems from men and problems from the system and the way things work and the way promotions work and CVs and preferences professionally, I think there's a lot going on with women that we also need to address ourselves to make working environments better for each other. Mm. That's one of the reasons why I no longer work for anyone. Why I work for myself, because it's easier. And that's a really sad reality. We lose good talent. And so I think I really wish there was a sisterhood chip that we could activate so that people would be that support to each other. Everyone's not going to like each other. Look, everyone's not going to get along. We're humans. Everyone's, you know, sometimes you find people annoying. It's natural. It's a thing. But what that doesn't need to then stray into is an unsupportive culture or a mean culture or a mobbing culture. That can still just stay as a, that person is not my preference and that's okay. I'm probably not theirs.
Exactly. Well, and there is also a lot of talk about allyship, and particularly, well, we talk about allyship in different environments, but in this case would be related to the male peers, so to the men working with women. Because I think sometimes actually, like we already say, they are more supportive than women towards a person progressing. So what's your experience or opinion on this?
I have a bit of a bad time with allyship in general because I just think it's basically being a good human being. So for me, I think sometimes we're giving people these cookies to like be nice, and that is very strange to me. Most people who I think have been supportive in my career, be them men, women, white people, you know, whatever, I don't think they've ever called themselves an ally. I think they've just gone about doing what they think is right. And I think also by calling it allyship, sometimes I think that puts an extra onus or burden on it, or an act of perceived goodness where people portray being an ally because they can make all the right noises and say all the right things, but actually that's not what they do in reality. But I think when it does come to what we would call allyship or supporting people, I think it's just really simple. And I think anyone can do it. You know, when a woman has a great idea, back it. You know, when a woman says something and then a man says it again and then everyone listens, say, oh, so-and-so just said that. Don't nick other people's ideas. You know, I think that's another thing that you see a lot of, people taking credit for other people's ideas. You know, if you know that someone else, a woman, you know, had a great idea, you know, she's under the cosh or whatever, she's trying to get that promotion, big her up for that good idea. Don't pretend that you did it. You know, don't ambush people with things in meetings when you could speak to them about it before the meeting or speak to them about it one-to-one and maybe clear the air. Don't feel like you need to do gotchas, you know, well, have you checked this and have you checked that, you know, just, you know, be supportive. And it's not about never, ever questioning anyone. Pull them to the side and say, you know what, I thought that was a great idea, but maybe you should think about this, this, this. You know, I wanted to support the idea, so I didn't want to raise that then, but I'm just saying to you now, I think you might need to think about this. But support people vocally, publicly. I think sometimes what happens, a lot of people support people privately. Oh, I think that was really out of order that so-and-so said that to you. Well, why don't you say that at the time then and not let that person sit in that by themselves in that moment of feeling embarrassed? In the moment, say, I don't, you know, or just back them in some way. You don't have to always put yourself in harm's way if you feel scared to, because I get it. It's tough times and we all need to keep a job. But there are still ways that you can support people publicly that will allow that person to not sit by themselves in like a really challenging moment. So I think if you want to be an ally, those are the good things. Have lunch with someone, you know, you see something about their work, tell them privately, you know, help them, you know, before the meeting. Hey, do you feel ready? Do you want to go over anything? You know, I'm sure you don't need my help, but it's there if you want it. There are so many ways that you can support people in their endeavors that would make a big, big difference to someone else and probably take a small chunk out of your day.
This leads me to the question about your book, because you wrote a book, Communicate for Change. How did the idea of writing this book came, and why do you think? Because it's really important, and it's not just for journalists, it's for people in general to learn a little bit more about how to be better listeners, readers, and watchers and talkers. So would you like to tell me a little bit more about it?
It was just all the stuff with Meghan Markle and all the headlines. And I was reading somewhere this week, which was so funny, that her and Harry have been together for 6.5 years. Gosh, it's been going on for a long time, this obsession that people have with her. But it was all of the headlines and people saying it's racist and other people saying it's not racist. And actually, there being no nuance in that conversation about the fact that you can't separate what people say about her from who she is. And part of who she is a woman of colour. So that cannot help but be part of it, of what is at the root of what people are talking about or their dis-ease with her. And it's clear to me to see that. I bet you some people don't think that they're racist, but I'm telling you, the things they're writing lets you know that there's something inside of them that is either racist or like a deeply held prejudice about who women of colour can be in the world and who the royal family should be dating. Now, just because you don't see that as racist doesn't mean it's not. And just because people don't like someone doesn't definitely mean they are racist. But I think it's something of the grey area in between where all of these things get jumbled up. But so often that nuance is lost from the conversation because people, one, there's nothing more that people hate than being called racist, even if they want to carry on doing racist things, they don't want to be called it. And two, you know, there's nothing worse than for some people that seeing that there and people just denying it. So I think I just thought, well, surely there's a better way to have this conversation that contains some nuance that allows people to explore all the different layers of things that are going on and to compare and contrast against like how Kate Middleton was treated, you know, because she was first dating Prince William. Everyone was having a go at her, you know, who's marrying a commoner. Her mom's an air stewardess. Gosh, they own like a, but then seeing her assimilation and how much easier that assimilation is for her because she looks like everybody else in that family and is the same race as everyone else in that family, and how Meghan will never look like that family and their children will never look like that family to a certain extent because of that. And so you have to interweave and interplay all of these things about race and class and gender and nationality and career choices prior, you know, all of these different things that add the nuance. And so I wanted to write a book that explored about how do we think about adding nuance to conversations. But I think most of these things have to start with, and rarely does start with, self-examination. What do I think about this person and why? And where are these narratives coming from? Where are these stories that I've got about this particular person because of X, Y, Z? Where are those things coming from? And so I think for me, communicating for change very much starts with self-communication and very much starts with self-awareness and self-examination of what we think and why. And only then can you actually have a decent conversation with someone else when you understand yourself and why you stand where you stand.
We should add this into the journalism curricula somewhere.
You know what?
not just the book itself, but actually, you know, to have a module or something for future journalists to have an honest conversation with themselves and understand a little bit more about their prejudice and their bias before they actually go out there and write a story that might damage someone or might not really give the full picture or be like completely biased. I think it's why not? It would be a great module to add, no?
No, you're right. People talk a lot about unconscious bias and I write about this in the book. It can become a bit of a hiding phrase and a shield. Oh, I just don't know because it's just all going on and I don't know that it's going on. Well, get to know what's going on in you. I know that there are some biases that I have because of, you know, and it might be down to an experience that I had even like at school or with a teacher or with a boss, you know, and it can put something in your mind that when you see certain things in certain groups of people happening, your mind immediately goes somewhere because of what you've experienced and what you've seen. But it's about understanding, I have this in me. So that means that I have, there's a high risk that I could prejudge a lot of people in certain situations because of this. I might be right with a lot of them, but I might be wrong with a lot of them too. And so actually that understanding of self knowing, and I think we use the word triggered far too much, but in this instance, knowing that if a certain kind of person, and for some people it would be different things, with a certain kind of accent comes to me and tells me off, that takes me somewhere. And they might be saying something valid, but I can't receive it, or I'm reluctant to receive it because of this past experience. Let me understand that about myself so that when I get into that situation, I can stop, think, okay, is this person saying something valid, or is this person like the other people like that? But just to not just shut it down immediately and think everyone is the same. Mm. Everyone isn't the same, and all Black people are not the same. And if we know that to be true of ourselves, then we mustn't say it's true of others. Because if we know that within the communities that we live in have diverse thinking and diverse ways of being and diverse, you know, ways of dealing with situations, then other groups will have that too. And how do we give that same grace that we would like to receive in individualistic situations?
Exactly. We are almost at the end. I've got just like two, three last questions, and they are more on about advices. So first, what advice would you give to your younger self?
To my younger self, I would say save more money. That's what I would say, because I think going through newsrooms, it depends on the kind of personality you are. I would never take too much. Like if I thought this is a joke, I'm off. And I think I wish I would have saved more money to have given myself more choices and options. Mm-hmm. But I know that saving money is actually really, really hard, and harder and harder and harder in journalism, because the pay is definitely not rising as quickly, you know, as other things. But I would say to myself, if you save more money, you'll give yourself more freedom. Even if it was just a little bit, you would give yourself more freedom. So I'd probably say save more money, and I would probably say be slightly less impulsive. So I'm quite an impulsive, so if I'm off, I'd probably say be a little bit more impulsive, take your time, think about different solutions before you kind of hit the nuclear button.
And an advice that you would like to give to younger female journalists?
Be assertive, I think, is the advice I would give. And sometimes it's really, really hard to be assertive. But I think get to know your non-negotiables. I think when you start out your career, you won't know them. I think in the first 2 to 3 years, you will kind of get to know your non-negotiables, and you will get to understand your boundaries. And I think that it is you teach people how to treat you. So if you don't have any boundaries, if you just say yes to everything, then people will ask you to do everything. And if you say yes when it's good for you and for them, you might not get asked to do everything, but you'll get better opportunities because people will see that you are picky for them. And I think the advice would be to know that you've got, when you're starting out your career in your 20s, you feel like you've got no time, you need to achieve everything. You've got like 40 years of work ahead of you. I would say you don't have to try and achieve everything in the first 5 years. It can seem really tempting and like things are going to pass you by if you don't achieve it now. But I think it's play the long game. You know, understand the long game. Give yourself a couple of years to kind of see what do you enjoy doing. You know, what are the kind of, who are the personalities you enjoy working with? What are the kind of areas that you like? And give yourself a little bit of time to figure that out, and never be afraid to jump if you need to, and never be afraid to stay if you need to. I think always think long term, because it's a long haul thing. And so to make a decision for today is really easy, but to make a decision for 5 years' time, 2 years' time can be a little bit harder, but play long game.
Mm-hmm. I like this. I agree. And you remember at the beginning, I asked you what is that you're fighting for. And to conclude this interview, the question is what you wish to stop fighting for.
I wish to stop fighting for everyone to have to fight to fulfill their potential. I think I wish to stop fighting for the thing I'm fighting for. And I long for a day where truly people see diverse characteristics as a blessing and addition to a team. And that it's never felt or never feels like a burden, never feels like it's a hard thing to have to include other people and include other opinions. So I wish to stop fighting for that. That's what I wish to stop fighting for. And I long for the day when truly, truly we pick a team. It's not just about highly skilled, but we pick a team that's well-rounded in skills and well-rounded in opinions, because we understand that that's the best way to reach a well-rounded audience.
Well, Janelle, thank you very, very much for being with us today. It was really a pleasure. And I hope to see you again soon on WEM Power. And thank you again so much.
Thank you for having me.
If this was your first time listening to WEM Power Podcast, thank you for taking the time. You can find us on Podbean and Spotify. Subscribe to our newsletter on wempower.co and keep up to date with all the future projects on all our social media at Wempower UK. Thank you to all the women out there that are following and supporting Wempower. I will continue to bring to you powerful, inspiring and positive stories from all over the world. Don't forget, together we empower women. This is Ilaria for Wempower Podcast. Until next time.